Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. WILL programs are made possible by Bevere Cafe, offering lunches from 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. Monday through Friday, and an early afternoon after hour from 1 to 3 p.m. featuring soups, sandwiches, salads, pastries, and specialty coffees. Bevere Cafe is student-operated in Bevere Hall, corner of Gregory and Goodwin, Urbana.
This is the Afternoon Magazine from Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2, online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Glad you could be with us today. David M. Walker served the Clinton and Bush administrations as Controller General and head of the U.S. Government Accountability Office. During his tenure, he began warning that America faces budgetary calamity. No longer in government, Walker continues to talk about our mounting debt and the consequences of that burden. David Walker is the author of a new book spelling out the dangers if the U.S. does not change course. The book also lays out his ideas for finding our way to fiscal sustainability. The title, Come Back America, Turning the Country Around and Restoring Fiscal Responsibility. David Walker is our guest this afternoon. Let me tell you a little bit more about him. He's a certified public accountant, currently the president and CEO of the Peter G. Peterson Foundation. The foundation calls itself nonpartisan and non-ideological. He served as the nation's top auditor from 1998 to 2008. His book, Come Back America, is published by Random House. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with a phone call or an email message, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Mr. Walker, good to talk with you. How are you?
Good to be with you, Celeste.
In speeches going back a couple of years, you told audiences our country is in a $56 trillion financial hole, and that was as of September 30th, 2008. $56 trillion?
It's worse now, Celeste. The new numbers haven't come out yet from the financial statements of the U.S. government because, you know, 2009 was a fairly busy year. We did a lot of stimulus efforts, did a lot of bailouts. I'm estimating that when the number comes out, the number as of September 30, 2009, will be well over $60 trillion, and that doesn't count the Federal Reserve and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which would be trillions more.
Now, when we talk this week, we're talking about the budget and the budget proposal from the Obama administration. And, you know, the headline is projected federal budget deficit for this fiscal year is $1.6 trillion. So where does $56, $60 trillion come from?
Here's what happens. There's three different numbers, okay? There's the deficit, which is how much, what the difference is between the revenues and expenditures for a given year. And President Obama estimates that it's going to be $1.6 trillion for the year ended September 30, 2010. That's 10 times higher than it was 3 years ago. Most of that was inherited. He inherited about a $1.2 trillion deficit, all right, from President Bush 43. The second is the debt, which is an accumulation of all past deficits. It's now about $12.3, $12.4 trillion. And then the number I came up with, which is now well over $60 trillion, you have to take the current debt as well as unfunded pensions, retiree health care for civilians and the military. You also have to look at the unfunded obligations for Medicare, $38 trillion, for Social Security, $7 to $8 trillion. You add all those together, and they all come from the audited financial statements of the U.S. government, and you get well over $60 trillion and climbing rapidly.
And is there a way really to dig yourself out of that, dig ourselves out of that?
Well, as we know, when you're in a hole, the first thing you have to do is stop digging. And then you need to have a plan as to how you're going to get out, and you need to have some safeguards to keep you from falling back in after you start making progress. And so the problem is not the short-term deficits. We're in a recession, although technically we may be out of it because we've had two quarters of positive economic growth. But, it sure doesn't feel that way, and unemployment's still very high. And so the fact is that, we may have to actually do more to stimulate employment in the short term. That may exacerbate the deficit. But what we've got to do is start putting our own financial house in order, because on the path that we're on now, even when the economy's growing, even when unemployment is down, even when we are out of Iraq and Afghanistan, we face large and growing deficits as far as the eye can see. And so President Obama has proposed this Fiscal Future Commission. That was one of the things I recommended in the book, which is great. Now he needs to make it a reality, and we need to do things to maximize the chance that it will be successful.
Talk about this idea for a Fiscal Future Commission. What is the commission's assignment, and who would be the commissioners?
Well, President Obama has to ultimately decide some of that, but basically here's what I think should be done, and as I lay it out in the book. We can't make progress on one difficult issue at a time, much less multiple issues, which is what we need to do now, because we're close to passing a tipping point with our foreign lenders. We need to reimpose tough statutory budget controls that would be in effect after we turn the corner on the economy and get unemployment down somewhat. We have to reform Social Security to make it solvent, sustainable, secure, and more savings-oriented. Frankly, it's not that difficult if we go about it the right way. We need to reduce health care costs and the rate of increase of health care costs. That's not what the current reform debate is about. That's what we need to do, or else it could bankrupt the country. We need to reform our tax system and raise more revenues in order to be able to deliver on our promises, or at least the ones we intend to keep. To do all of those things, it's going to take a special commission that will do two things. It will engage the American people with the facts, the truth, the tough choices around the country, leverage the Internet, and then make recommendations that will receive not just hearings, but a vote in the Congress. Ideally, should be comprised of bipartisan members of Congress, a couple of representatives from the administration, and probably a half a dozen capable, credible, and committed non-government people who know what they're talking about, who the people will listen to, and who don't wear a strong R or D on their sleeve, because, quite frankly, the people don't like either party right now.
Yeah. It's interesting. One of the things I think you say at the end of the book is we need to talk about nonpartisan rather than bipartisan.
Well, Celeste, you're exactly right. I believe we need nonpartisan and non-ideological solutions that can achieve bipartisan support. I'm a political independent, and I have been since 1997, and fortunately I think I was ahead of the curve on that. Now we have a plurality of Americans who are political independents. That's what happened in Massachusetts. That was not a Republican victory. That was a rise of the independents, an expression of frustration and growing anger with the status quo, with business as usual, with incumbents. And so we're going to have to do things differently, and the people are starting to wake up and demand that we do things differently.
You began speaking out on fiscal responsibility in 2003 during the administration of George W. Bush. What did you see at that time that troubled you, and how did you make this decision to become a public figure, really, because the controller is not usually out there?
Right. You're correct. Basically, when I came into office in November of 1998, we were running a surplus and things were looking good. But in 2001, when the new administration came in, the surplus was burning a hole in everybody's pocket. People wanted to do spending increases, they wanted to do tax cuts, they wanted to do entitlement expansions. And so I was testifying, "Ooh, go slow, this is a projected surplus, it may or may not happen. Plus, we know we've got structural deficits in the future for Medicare and Social Security we're going to have to deal with. unfortunately, they didn't pay enough attention. The statutory budget controls that helped us go from large and growing deficits to large and growing surpluses expired at the end of 2002, and it was very clear to me that things were out of control. Congress was talking about expanding Medicaid to add prescription drugs. The most imprudent thing that you can do is add a new entitlement benefit. And so in September of 2003, I gave a speech called Truth and Transparency. It's on GAO's website at gao.gov. Basically blowing the whistle on what was going on. And so, this, you know, I'm not just now speaking out now that I'm out of office. I was very vocal, but now I can do things I couldn't do then, like advocate specific solutions, try to help to, you know, support grass tops and grassroots efforts to bring pressure on Washington to act and to hold it accountable if it fails to act.
Yeah. What did the Bush-Cheney team think of that 2003 speech?
You know, I mean, I never got a call from, you know, from the team. I mean, you know, what I found was it was amazing how much I could say as long as I did several things, which I was absolutely committed to. Fact-based, nonpartisan, non-ideological, non-personal. You know, it's a, you can do a lot of things as long as you follow those basic rules. And I did then, and I continue to now.
In 2005, you and some others hit the road on a fiscal wake-up tour. Besides yourself, who was on the tour and who turned out to hear what you had to say?
Well, there were several organizations that represented the core. In addition to myself as Comptroller General of the United States and head of the GAO, we had the Concord Coalition. Bob Bixby, who's head of the Concord Coalition, was the most frequent representative of that organization. We had the Brookings Institution, and there were a number of people involved there, including Bell Sawhill and you know, Alice Rivlin and Doug Elmendorf, the current head of CBO. We had the Heritage Foundation, a number of people involved there, including people like, you know, Stuart Butler and Allison Frazier and Brian Riedel. And, you know, occasionally we would have other groups like AARP or AEI or the Progressive Policy Institute. But the key was you had a broad spectrum from right to left and sensible center, basically stating the facts, speaking the truth, helping people understand that we had a serious problem, we need to start doing something about it. Reasonable people can and will differ about what the answer is, but doing nothing is not an option.
You mentioned a moment or two ago the Medicare prescription benefit that was enacted during the administration of George W. Bush. You know, we're often presented with proposals that are supposed to pay for themselves. How do we evaluate those claims?
Well, first, Columbus proved a long time ago that the earth is round, not flat. And yet Washington continues to use a flat earth budget policy. By that I mean they only look at things for 10 years, and they do a lots of gaming. You know, and they did that for Medicare Part D, and they're doing it for the current health care reform, where they'll end up, you know, having revenues and savings that, that count for the full 10 years or, you know, or more years during the 10 years than the expenditures count. And so that makes things look like that they're better than they are, and then they don't end up tending to look beyond 10 years when, in many cases, because of demographics and a variety of other factors, things get a lot worse. And so I outline in the book a number of things that we need to do to change our budget system and what type of statutory budget controls we need to put back in place, you know, frankly, tougher than the ones that we had that expired in 2002. But those shouldn't be implemented fully until after we get unemployment down and are sure that we've turned the corner on the economy for pretty obvious reasons.
Mm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is David M. Walker. He is currently president and CEO of the Peter G. Peterson Foundation. He's the former Comptroller General of the United States, serving from 1998 to 2008. He is the author of Come Back America, Turning the Country Around and Restoring Fiscal Responsibility. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. And you could also join us with an email message. Our email address, will-talk@illinois.gov. UConnect.edu. Let's take a call from a listener, someone calling in from Geneva, line 4. Good afternoon.
Hey, good afternoon. Yeah, I was wondering, you know, I'm kind of curious, the way the economy is now, if you look at the stock market, you know, it goes up and up and up, and everybody's going, everything else is going down. I can't figure that one out. But having worked for a municipality years ago, and even to this point, they have no control over their budget. They basically spend, they've got to spend, if they have, you know, $1 million in a, you know, check for them, they basically spend $1 million. If there's anything left over, they won't put it in the bank. They have to spend it, because I've had to deal with that. To me, I think we need to change the way the system is. If you've got leftover money, no matter what budget it is and what it's for, you ought to put it in some kind of form of government or municipality fund where it let collect, you know, interest, because inevitably you're going to have a down year, and that will save your butt, because that's exactly what happened in this one municipality. I worked there for years, and the same thing with the federal government. Having been an ex-employee of the federal government, there's no control over their spending. Now, I do realize, you know, there's a lot of needs out there, and that's the problem. We've got all these special interest groups. We've got special, you know, every time I turn around, there's another way to spend money. I think what I don't understand is why we don't and why we haven't kept a cap on it. And the other thing is, why haven't the congressmen and the senators taken a pay cut like everybody else? I mean, they're going after CEOs of companies.
Okay, caller?
That's a lot. Let me try to hit some of that.
Yeah.
First, the biggest problem that we have is spending is out of control. George W. Bush 43, was the biggest spending president since Lyndon Baines Johnson. And it wasn't just on defense and homeland security. I mean, he was a big spending president. He also expanded entitlement benefits, again, the most since Lyndon Baines Johnson. And, you know, we had a situation where the debt of the United States almost doubled in his 8 years. Now, on the other hand, Barack Obama, he inherited, President Obama inherited a $1.2 trillion deficit, but the first two appropriations bills that he signed increased discretionary spending over 20% in 2 years, despite little to no inflation. I'm not talking about the stimulus or the bailouts. This is just the base of government. You know, spending is absolutely out of control, and we need to bring back tough statutory spending controls, really meaningful pay-as-you-go rules. We need to have caps on discretionary spending, and we also need to resist expanding entitlement programs when we have tens of trillions of dollars of unfunded promises for existing entitlement programs that we don't know what we're going to deal with, how we're going to pay for.
And I want to thank the listener for his call. We've got some other folks that are joining us. And so next we're going to go to Spring Bay, line 1. Hi.
Yes, good afternoon. I saw your IOUSA movie a while back. Thought that was well done.
Thank you. And we've got a new one coming out, an update coming out within a month. IOUSA Solutions. It's only going to be about 30 minutes. We're going to give it away for free. And we've got a tentative agreement with CNN to do a special on it.
Well, that's good. I was reading an essay recently. A fellow was saying that he was sort of asking the question, where are we going to get the productivity or the growth to pull ourselves out of this situation in terms of we've sort of gotten rid of all of our manufacturing capacity? And where do you see the growth or the employment now coming in the future? And I'll get off and listen. Thanks for the good program.
Well, thank you for your question. It's an excellent one. You know, I think we have to recognize that the United States can't compete on wages, and we don't want to compete on wages because our standard of living would go down. So therefore, we've got to compete on innovation, value-added, productivity, those types of factors. Now, what does that mean? That means that we need to have higher skilled and knowledgeable workers, which means we have to have a first-rate education system. We're not top 25 in the world in K-12 education. That means we need to be investing a lot more in basic research and critical infrastructure,
We're not doing that. We're below average with regard to those as well. And so we need to kind of step back and quit resting on our past success and our current sole superpower status, which is temporary, and start looking at leading indicators and start taking steps to try to address what some of our structural problems are so that we can end up being more competitive going forward. You know, you're not going to enhance your competitive posture by engaging in financial engineering that makes a few people a lot of money but doesn't do much for society as a whole.
And next we take a call from a listener in Champaign, line two. Hi.
Good afternoon. Good program. Thanks. My question is, what role or what part of the of this train wreck are the state budgets and financial situations in? The states, many states, including Illinois, seem to be having tremendous problems with their budgets. And how does that all fit together with the federal budget problems? And does your solution address that? I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay.
Another excellent question. Well, first, the book overwhelmingly focuses on the federal financial challenge, which is the greatest. At the same point in time, it's not the only financial challenge. About 42 of the 50 states face serious budget problems for 2010, and they're expected to continue for a while. And they have serious structural deficit problems because of growing Medicaid costs, unfunded retiree health care for government workers and retirees, underfunded pension plans for government workers and retirees, deferred maintenance and other critical infrastructure needs, and escalating higher education costs. So those are the drivers of the state budget. There's clearly increased interdependency between federal, state, and local. You know, bad news, as we all know, flows downhill. So when the federal government hits the wall, that means it's going to be able to do less for the states. So there's no question that our national challenge, which is the sum of federal, state, local, is greater than our federal challenge, but the greatest challenge is federal. The difference also with the states is all but one state either have constitutional or statutory requirements for a balanced budget. They can't print money. And therefore, they end up hitting the wall quicker than the federal government because of those facts.
Hmm. And the state of Illinois has a requirement in the Constitution for a balanced budget. We haven't had one for I don't know how long.
Depends on how you define a balanced budget. You know, and that's really key, you know, because one of the things that you find in government is that the words that are used in government don't mean the same thing as Webster's Dictionary. And I'll give you a couple examples at the federal level. The word cut means an absolute reduction. Not in government. It means reduce the rate of increase. That's not a cut. Secondly, trust funds. In the private sector, trust funds are separate and distinct legal entity. You have fiduciary responsibility and liabilities. There's prohibited transaction rules, and you go to jail, potentially, if you breach your fiduciary responsibilities. In the federal government, they're accounting devices. They're trusted government funds. They're not separate legal entities. They have no real, you know, invested assets in them. And that's one of the reasons the government doesn't have any credibility, because it uses its own language that doesn't mean the same thing as Webster's Dictionary.
Hmm. Do you think that's part of why, as voters, we're confused or led astray?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And another example is in defense. There's tremendous waste in defense. And I have a chapter dedicated to defense in there, too. But one of the things is that, you know, the way the law says that the Defense Department is not supposed to consider the cost of anything that it considers to be a requirement. Well, that opens up a great opportunity for abuse. And it's led us to buying a lot of things based on past threats rather than current and future threats. It's led us to have a lot more things in the pipeline that we can't afford and sustain. And so when you hit the wall, you may find yourself having a lot of things that people wanted, but not enough of what we need to protect national security.
Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign County on line three. Hi.
Hi. I'm very concerned about the several trillions of dollars spent on offense, the phony war, phony causes belli in Iraq, but that's a digression. I disagree that this is a good show. I want to be too cantankerous here, but I think there's something needs to be questioned. And I refer people to the book by Dean Baker and Mark Weisbrot called Social Security, The Phony Crisis, which The Economist said that in this book they had no trouble demonstrating that even on highly conservative assumptions about economic growth, the much forecast insolvency of the Social Security system by 2030 is most unlikely to happen then, if indeed ever. So that's from The Economist that say that this is at least an argument worth looking at. Now, Dean Baker has also been in the news lately about how the news is being made. The Peterson Institute, amongst its many things that it's funding, they fund the World Focus program on public TV.
Actually, the Peterson Foundation does, not the Peterson Institute. They're a little separate and distinct.
It's all from the billionaires' resources, though, isn't it?
Actually not, but that's okay. I mean, it'd be good to have some facts. Dean Baker doesn't always get his facts right. But go ahead, finish your thought, and I'll respond.
Well, Baker points out that the Washington Post, which has been a deficit hawk and has been beating this drum for a while, has taken material from the Fiscal Times, is it called?
Yes, it's a separate and distinct legal entity, right.
Which is also funded by Peterson's resources.
That's
so
true.
The argument is that... I don't like the deficit. I don't like what it's being spent on. But if it's done as an investment into the future infrastructure, et cetera, instead of blowing up another country, I think it's a good thing to do, just as long-term debt is good for an individual if they're buying a house, generally,
as long as
they don't go underwater. But I just take issue with this whole commonplace, this whole basic proposal that you have, that we're in such a desperate crisis that we need to go back on the promise of Social Security, which people of my age have been paying into for quite a while.
Sure.
And to cut that back after the promise has been made is not fiduciary responsibility. And if it's indeed true, as The Economist points out, that this is not really a likely scenario, I think that people ought to really question this premise.
Okay. Well, first, let's just set some facts straight. I was a trustee of Social Security and Medicare from 1990 to 1995. Frankly, I know about those programs a lot better than Dean Baker ever will. Secondly, the fact of the matter is that there is broad-based agreement that Social Security does not face an immediate crisis. It is negative cash flow. It does have a $7 to $8 trillion deficit that grows with the passage of time. That's a fact. There's no debate about that. The real problem is Medicare, which is underfunded $38 trillion. You can solve Social Security pretty easily, and in fact, I have a chapter in the book. I believe very strongly that we need to make Social Security solvent, sustainable, secure, and more savings-oriented. It needs to be a defined benefit program for a lot of reasons. We should have a supplemental savings account, not a substitute, and I would encourage you to read the book. Secondly, I believe that we're wasting a lot of money in defense and that we never should have invaded Iraq. We didn't even declare a war. My son fought in Iraq, but we shouldn't have had that war for a lot of different reasons. So I would just encourage you to read the book. But the fact of the matter is that you can't just look at one issue at a time. Yes, we can solve Social Security. Yes, we can get out of, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan. But our financial problem is serious. You have to look at the big picture. And when you look at the big picture, people from the left and the right agree. There's no way we can avoid making tough choices, which involves statutory budget controls, renegotiate the social insurance contract, reduce and control health care costs, and reform the tax system and raise more revenues. You got to do all of that. It's just very simple. It's math.
Does a listener want to follow up?
Not everybody agrees with your math, and I commend people's attention to Baker and Weisbrot. But, you just admitted that Social Security can be fixed.
I agree. And that's what I say in the book. Please read the book.
I'm asking you, I guess, to outline what your proposals are.
I'll be happy to
get rid of the upper limit so that Bill Gates is not paying the same amount of Social Security, FICA, as somebody who makes just barely enough to get by.
I'll give you the highlights of what I say, okay? First, you want to gradually increase the normal and the early retirement age over about 20 years and then index it to life expectancy. Secondly, increase the benefit for people near the poverty level because we have too many people that are relying solely on Social Security as their primary form of retirement income. Never intend to be that way, but that's the way it is. Thirdly,
provide somewhat less of a replacement rate for middle and upper income individuals, but don't make it fully means tested. Thirdly, or fourthly, raise the taxable wage base cap from about $107,000 to about $150,000 and continue to index it, okay? Fifthly, once you do those things, you have a solvent, sustainable, and secure defined benefit program indefinitely that increases the progressivity of the program, that you're not pre-programmed to have to come back. But the last thing is add on an automatic supplemental, not carve-out, so it's an add-on rather than a carve-out, automatic savings account, 2 to 3% of pay that goes into a real trust fund with real investments, with real fiduciary responsibility and liabilities, like the Federal Thrift Savings Plan, that provides a pre-retirement death benefit, a supplemental retirement benefit, and increases our savings rate. Those things will achieve multiple objectives, and after having been to 46 states in the last 4 years, they can achieve broad-based support among the American people.
This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is David M. Walker, President and CEO of the Peter G. Peterson Foundation. He's a former Comptroller General of the United States, serving from 1998 to 2008. He is the author of Comeback America, Turning the Country Around and Restoring Fiscal Responsibility. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's take another call, a listener in Champaign. Line one, hi.
Hi. You know, I think one of the problems we face is most Americans have no idea what the federal budget on a yearly basis really looks like. And I think that if people understood, like, I think we generate like $1.3 trillion in revenue from income taxes, about $1 trillion in revenue from Social Security and Medicare taxes, and then other forms of taxes. Of course, we've eliminated the estate tax temporarily, so it doesn't even bring in any revenue. But then they have no idea where our outflows are and how they're affected by different confluence of events that can happen over a period of time, such as like if we'd have a major spike in interest rates, how that would have a huge impact on how much money we're spending. And quite frankly, if you look at the sources of our revenue, I don't think many people realize that Social Security and Medicare bring in almost as much revenue to the federal government every year as income tax.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those are excellent points. Let's just take an example, okay, for the fiscal 2011 budget that President Obama has proposed. That would be for the year beginning, you know, October 1, 2010 through September 30, 2011. $2.5 trillion in revenues, $3.8 trillion in spending, $1.3 trillion deficit. Now, technically, the economists would tell you that we're out of the recession. Sure doesn't feel like it to me, but that's what they would tell you based upon the historical level. So that means that type of deficit, even though they're expecting 3 to 4% economic growth next year. Secondly, the caller is correct that we need to understand where do we get our money from and where do we spend it. Right now, we get almost as much money from the payroll taxes as we do the income tax. The simple fact of the matter is 40% plus of Americans pay no income taxes, headed to 50% plus. They do pay payroll taxes, but those payroll taxes are not adequate to fund the programs that they're targeted to support. And in addition, they're rightfully geared more towards providing people that are less well off. That's fully understandable. They're social insurance programs, okay? We have a situation also where defense, we spend a lot of money, about 20% of the budget, but now less than 40% of the budget is controlled by the Congress. Over 60% is set by law and increases automatically. And guess what? Of the less than 40% that is controlled by the Congress, that includes every express and enumerated responsibility the Founding Fathers envisioned for the federal government under the Constitution. The government has grown dramatically in some ways that make sense, in some ways that don't. But in some cases, the government has overpromised and underdelivered and thrown money and tax preferences at things that frankly just don't work. And so we're going to have to basically engage in a pretty broad-based fundamental reexamination that's going to take a number of years to try to put ourselves in a more prudent and sustainable path.
So, listener, want to follow up?
Yeah, you know, I agree with you. But the dilemma we've got is we've almost got ourselves not whole. We've almost got ourselves in a cement coffin. The problem we've got, and I don't, you know, a lot of these problems stem back with the Arthur Laffer theory of the supply curve, that we would loosen tax rates up to the point where the government wouldn't be generating as much revenue directly from the taxes that we had anticipated, but it would generate a lot more revenue in the future because we lowered tax rates, and that would increase spending, and that would increase the economy, and we'd grow so fast that that'd generate a lot more tax revenue, and we'd bring it all in. And in fact, it hasn't worked. The government has spent a ton of money, but we haven't increased revenues. I mean, we're only bringing in $1.3 trillion in income tax this year, and we're spending $3.8 trillion, and the problem is
this year 3.5, next year 3.8, right?
Yeah, we will never generate enough money in income tax revenues to pay the way of the government. It's
important. Well, and that's why. Well, first, let's just quickly about the Laffer curve. Even Arthur Laffer would say that his curve has been misrepresented. Not all tax cuts stimulate the economy. Very, very, very few tax cuts pay for themselves. By that I mean, you end up generating more revenues after the tax cut than otherwise you would generated had you not done the tax cut. The only two that show that can possibly do that are dramatic reductions in marginal tax rates, like we got under John F. Kennedy. And marginal tax rates are a lot lower than they were back then, so you're not gonna pay for itself there. And then number two, dramatic reductions in tariffs. Well, we now have a lot of free trade agreements. We don't have, high tariffs. And so, that concept is just flawed. Ultimately, we're going to have some type of a progressive consumption tax, probably a VAT tax earmarked for health care. But, you can't solve this problem just with revenues. You got to put budget controls in place. We've got to constrain and reprioritize spending. But we're going to need more revenues over historical levels.
I want to thank the listener for the call. Let's take another call. Urbana, line two. Hi.
Hello. I'm glad you're admitting what most conservatives want, that we need more revenues as part of the solution. My concern with restructuring Social Security is that we have an economy which, if someone loses a job after 50, 55, they essentially are unemployable. And to push back the retirement age to 67, which I think is entirely in keeping with human potential today, people can certainly are more capable of working at 65, 67, 70 than they were probably in their 50s 50 years ago. Mm-hmm. But unless you can do something with this problem with employing someone in their 50s and 60s, I don't see how you can, with any degree of conscience, push back that age limit or entitlement.
Sure, I understand. Well, let me address a little bit of that, okay? First, the first social insurance program in the history of the Western world was Germany. Otto von Bismarck. He was a brilliant politician. He made a liberal promise that was fiscally conservative. He said, if you live to 70, we will provide you a modest patch on the pants pension. And it was the industrial age, so most people earned through manual labor. But the average life expectancy in Germany was 55, so there weren't that many people that got it. Fast forward to 1935, when Social Security came in. We promised that we would pay Social Security for people that were 65, and life expectancy was a little bit less than 65. And now we have a situation where life expectancy is much longer. We now are not in the industrial age. We're in the knowledge age. People are living longer. They're living healthier. The economy is less manual labor-oriented. And when you look forward, you see that our workforce growth is expected to slow dramatically. You are correct that there are a number of employers that are not enlightened, and they need to become enlightened. But if you look at what's going on with regard to the change of the economy, longer lifespans, healthier people later in life, it is in the interest of public policy to encourage, not necessarily require, to encourage the people to work longer. The other thing that ends up happening is that private pension plans end up piggybacking on public policies. My dad was an executive for Southern Bell. He retired at 62 because his pension plan said that that's what the government says, so that's when you're going to retire. And you know, it kind of gave the green light signal that that's when you're supposed to retire. And needless to say, he's well into his 80s and you know, hopefully will be with us many more years. So you're right, employers need to become enlightened, but public policy needs to encourage things that are in the national best interest.
Follow up? No.
I think it has to do more than encourage. I think it has to be a rather stringent requirements that people not be fired because they're drawing higher wages in their later years and simply because they're older.
Oh, I hear you. Well, I'm totally for, you know, enforcing the age discrimination laws. I mean, you know, I'm with you on that.
Let's take another call, probably our last call this afternoon. Chicago, line 4, hi.
The means of employment has been subordinated by the fact that robots and semi-lines and computerization programming have displaced the human factor in the production process. And so, therefore, when humans are no longer relegated to their former positions of employment, what's to become of humans and the tax revenue that they supply when they pay their income taxes? Apparently, the load is going to fall upon business to take over this function of revenue raising for the government, and then also this whole matter of regulation and accountability, which is just a farce when it comes to really the Defense Department and other things like the banking system going around haphazardly creating the situations, resulting in any number of people coming up with books that are talking about the Federal Reserve System and on, you know. So we've got a dilemma that has to talk about the future more and its impact upon us, like sustainability and all the other environmental factors. So there's a heap of things. I wish you could talk for another hour or two. Your comments are beautiful.
And we're running out of time. So, David Walker, you want to respond
to
this
caller? Thank you, sir. You're correct that automation has had a major impact. You know, on one hand, it increases productivity, but on the other hand, it has a very real human cost and also an economic cost. You know, we also need to really relook at our tax system. I mean, my view is we're going to have to, as I mentioned before, go more towards a progressive consumption tax, which in many ways will end up having people that are of substantial wealth pay a lot more money than otherwise they would pay under the current tax system. But a lot of great questions, and I really appreciate the opportunity, Celeste.
Yeah. We're winding up here. We do have a couple of minutes left, mm-hmm. and we have an email message, a comment. The listener says, if I heard him correctly, he says Social Security can be fixed with several actions when what our listener thinks all we need to do is take the cap off altogether. What do you think?
I don't think we ought to take the cap off altogether. That's a 12.4% across-the-board tax increase in what is supposed to be a social insurance program. We need more revenues, but I think we ought to do it directly rather than indirectly. You know, those revenues are supposed to be earmarked for that program. People that are better off ought to be paying more in taxes, but we need to be very careful about how we raise those revenues so we don't undermine public support for the social insurance programs, and so that we have adequate revenues but more equitable ways of raising those revenues than we do right now.
Yeah. A few minutes ago, you mentioned Medicare as being a big problem, and this is another area of the budget that is mandatory. Mm-hmm. Would you talk with us just briefly here at the end about your ideas for Medicare?
First, we're the only industrialized nation in the world that doesn't have a budget on what it spends on health care. It'll bankrupt us. We have to have a budget. Secondly, we need to move away from fee-for-service payment systems to more evidence-based medicine, pay more for results. Other countries have done that. Thirdly, you know, we need to have more competitive bidding with regard to the acquisition of, you know, of products and prescription drugs and other things with regard to federal government programs. You know, fourthly, we need to change the tax subsidies for employer-provided and paid health care. If you have very lucrative plans, whether you're in a union or not, You ought to pay taxes on amounts in excess of a certain level. We need to change the subsidies for Medicare Part B and D, which are voluntary programs that provide for people of substantial wealth and income to get taxpayer subsidies that are paid for by our kids and grandkids with interest. Those are a few ideas. There's a lot more in the book.
Okay. Well, there we will leave it. David Walker, thank you for talking with us this afternoon.
It's a pleasure. Thank you. And I'll be in Chicago on Monday at the Union League for a speech.
Okay, very good. David M. Walker, President and CEO of the Peter G. Peterson Foundation, former Controller General of the United States, author of Comeback America, Turning the Country Around and Restoring Fiscal Responsibility. The book is published by Random House. 9 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, settlement prices should be in from Kansas City and Chicago from the Boards of Trade. Here with those numbers, Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. The Chicago Board of Trade, just a couple of doors down, actually, from the Chicago Union League, is where all the action took place to this day, as it always does in the trade for the futures market. Corn futures were about a penny higher today, and the beans were up 5 cents in the nearby. Wheat futures in that March contract up 6 3/4, the high today at $4.82, the low at $4.66.5, settlement price at $4.75 3/4, 6 3/4 higher for the soft red winter wheat. May futures, $4.95 3/4 high on the day, the low at $4.80 3/4, settlement price at $4.90, up 6.5 cents, and the July contract, a $5.07 3/4 top bottom at $4.91, settlement price at $5.02 2 1/4, up 6 3/4 on the afternoon. September futures, a 5.22 1/4 top, bottom at 5.09 1/4, settlement price at 5.18, 6 3/4 higher, and the March wheat for the hard red in Kansas City, a 5 1/4 cent gain today at $4.88 1/4. From the corn pit, futures managed to pick up a penny today after heavy losses yesterday. 1 cent higher in the nearby March contract with a trading range of about a dime, $3.59 the high, the low at 49. That's not about, but exactly a dime, with a settlement price at $3.54 and the March contract lead option a penny higher in the corn futures. May contract in Chicago, 3.70 1/4 the high, the low at 60 1/4, settled at $3.65 1/4, 3/4 higher. In July, 3.80 1/4 the high, the low at 3.70 3/4, settlement price at 3.75 1/2, up 3/4 cents. September futures, 3.86 1/4 the high, the low at 78 1/2, $3.82 3/4 the settlement price, unchanged from yesterday afternoon. December contract unchanged as well, $3.95 the top, the bottom at $3.85, settlement price at $3.89 3/4. December corn for this year unchanged. That's the new crop contract. The 2011 March contract in the corn pit, $4.06 the high, low at $3.97 1/4, settlement price at $4.02. March oat futures today, a 2.31 3/4 top, bottom at 2.27 1/2, a settlement price there at 2.28 3/4, 2 1/4 lower. The May futures at 2.38, down 2 1/4. From the soy complex now, nearby March beans again today, $9.16 the high, the low at $9, settlement price at $9.14, up on the top end of the trading range, a gain of 6 cents. March beans up 6 this afternoon. May futures at 9.26 1/2 top, bottom at 9.11. Settlement price at 9.24 3/4, 5 3/4 higher. And the July futures, 9.35 the high, the low at 9.20, settlement price at 9.33 1/2, a nickel higher on the afternoon. August soybean futures, 9.31 1/2 the high, the low at 16 3/4, settlement price at $9.30, up 5 1/2. And September, 9.15 the high, the low at 9.06 3/4, settlement price at 9.18, up 5 1/2 cents. November soybean futures, 9.14 the high, the low at 8.99 1/2. New crop November beans, $9.10, a settlement price 3 cents higher. The rest of the pit up 3 as well. January up 3 at 9.19, the March at 9.27 up 3, and the May of 2011 at 9.28 1/2, a 3 cent gain. May bean meal futures, a 2.65 top today, bottom at 259.90, settlement price there $264.20, up $1.10. The nearby March finished $2.30 higher at $271.20, with a top of $71.80 and a bottom of $65.50. Again, March bean meal at $271.20 a ton, up $2.30. March bean oil today, $37.44 the high, the low at $36.69. Settlement price at $37.21, up 31 cents. In the May soybean oil, $37.90 the high, low at $37.18. Settlement price at $37.68, up $2.32 on the afternoon. During the closing market report this afternoon, we'll be joined by Kurt Kimmel. Dan Zwicker of ADM Grain Group is away from the office, so Kurt at Bates Commodities will pick up that slack. And then Pete Levitt is away, and the good news is our own chief meteorologist Ed Kieser will be here to take up the agricultural weather forecast, and it all happens in just about 6 minutes during the closing market report at 6 after the hour, or rather 10 minutes at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock Central Time. I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Mike Morris in McHenry at 815-344-7213. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
And now we turn our attention to the livestock contracts and how they finish the day today in Chicago. February live cattle, the high 86.62.5, the settlement 85.90, the settlement 86.55, up 10. April 90.10, the high 89.25, the low 90.07.5, the settlement down 2.5. June 88 even, the high 87.22.5, the low 87.85, the settlement down 20. August 87.25, the high 86.62.5, the low, the settlement 87.25, down 12.5. March feeder cattle 97.70, the high 97.15, the low, the settlement 97.25, down 15. April 99.25, the high 98.80, the low 98.97.5, the settlement down 40. May $100.25, the high, the low 99.90, $100.25. Today's settlement down 17.5. August 101.75, the high 101.37.5, the low, the settlement 101.72.5, down 15. February lean hog 66.17.5, the high 65.60, the low 66.15, the settlement up 2.5. April 67.07.5, today's high, the low 66.30, the settlement 66.92.5, that down 15. May 72.72.5, the high 72 even, the low, the settlement 72.62.5, down 40. And June lean hogs 75.70, the high 75.20, the low 75.65, the settlement down 25. February bellies 81.75, the high 80 even, the low, the settlement 81.75, down 30. The Dow currently off 205 points at 10,065. The NASDAQ is off 50 at 2141. The S&P 500 down 26 at 1,072. Nearby crude down 393 at 73.05. 2 minutes before 2 o'clock, this is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3, Urbana. 36 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois. WILL is a listener-supported broadcasting service of the College of Media at Illinois. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our technical director is Henry Frayne. The forecast for Illinois and Indiana, we have some advisories to tell you about. First, a winter weather advisory for snow is in effect for portions of southwestern Illinois from 6 p.m. this evening to 6 p.m. tomorrow evening, and for portions of west central Illinois from midnight tonight to 6 p.m. tomorrow evening. Winter storm watch in effect across central into portions of southern Indiana from late tonight through Saturday morning, and for southeastern Indiana from Friday morning through Saturday afternoon. And an air quality alert and an air pollution action day has been declared today for the Chicago area. The forecast for the two states this afternoon, mostly cloudy, a mix of rain and sleet will arrive in far southern Illinois, highs ranging from 32 in far northern Illinois to 42 in far southern Indiana. Tonight, far south, rain elsewhere in the south and into central Indiana, a mix of rain, freezing rain, sleet, and snow arriving. In central and northern Illinois and northern portions of central Indiana, snow arriving overnight. And for northern Indiana, cloudy skies tonight. Lows ranging from 24 in northeastern Indiana to 34 in the far south. Tomorrow, far south, rain